from MLU headquarters in Philadelphia. This is Cleats and Cuffy. Everything ultimate, from the field to the border.
Hello, Mr. Graham.
Hello and welcome to Cleats and Cufflinks. We're here. It's another episode, episode 28. I'm here with Dusty Rhodes. You know, he hates this, former GM of the DC Current, but also obviously on-air analyst over the course of this past year, and all-around frisbee guru. Let's say that.
Well, you know, I'm happy to say I'm the former DC Current GM. you can't run from what you did. You have to kind of figure out who you are and what you're trying to do here.
How you
GMing wasn't the right role for me. I'm happy to say I found a better spot.
There you go. And then, and you know, DC found the GM they need.
You
know,
yeah, Matt. Yeah, you've been doing a great job down there. I love talking to him about the frizz.
We were talking about it earlier, though. He has kept some of the crew that you put together down there. It's a tight-knit team down there on the DC Current.
It's the sort of thing where being involved at the beginning gives you this sort of, even though I'm not technically involved with their team specifically, you take a little bit of pride in seeing them succeed. Not just the players, the staff as well. There's a decent amount of carryover since I was specifically doing with that, and I've been happy to see everything they've done since then. I think that they've done a better job since I left, which is not necessarily bad on me, but good on them.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. So anyway, yeah, we're here, episode 28, you know, continuing the ongoing series of the rotating, we'll call it guest host, as I'm not really comfortable with a full-on interview show, so this this is a guest host type scenario.
Show.
It's our show together, and it's not the first time that we've worked directly together like this. We actually played Ultimate together a number of years ago.
Do you know what that number is?
It's a big number. It's a double-digit kind of number.
It's getting up there now.
Yeah, yeah. So 10 or 11 years ago, depending on which year you prefer.
Yeah, it's that sort of thing where it's like graduating high school. You go back to that first reunion, and that's really exciting. You see people you haven't seen for a while, except for in the Facebook era, of course.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Now you're just tired.
You go back and you see people, and you're like, oh, you're just the same as you were, but now go back and you see people, and they don't really look like frisbee players anymore. They look like adults, like the rest of us.
Yeah.
It's very strange.
They look like me.
But having that experience where you get to go back and share a little bit of what you did with other folks, it's like that's kind of the beauty of sports, right? Like that's why we do it, is you share these experiences.
Absolutely, and we were actually talking about that, when we were talking earlier, because we got talking. You know, you've been here all day today. We get some breakfast at Honey's Sit and Eat.
One of my favorite places in Philly. Both of them. Even though there didn't used to be two.
Are there two?
Yeah, there's one down in South Street or something.
Really?
Yeah, they opened up a new location.
Who knew? I don't hold with it. Honey Sit and Eat in Northern Liberties.
Yes.
The real Honey Sit and Eat. And then we had a lot of coffee. We talked about statistics, but we also talked a little bit about this idea of sort of what you were talking about there, like the idea of players and how they develop through their careers to the point where they can start to give back and to teach. And we talk specifically about, Kevin Garnett is where this all came from. You're a big basketball fan.
Can't help myself.
Which I'm not, to be perfectly honest, but I like basketball stories. And I read a lot about these kind of like past stars. I was a fan back in like the Jordan Bird era. That's the last time I watched. But.
Oh, you are a little bit older than me. That's okay. For me, it was more the Barkley era.
Okay. Yeah.
All that stuff beforehand, Dr. J, et cetera, that was when I was just a little kid. But after that, I mean, so we're talking about Kevin Garnett, and one of the things that has happened in his career is he's very obviously at the tail end of his career. He started off with the Timberwolves, went through his winning championship with the Celtics, then got tossed off to the Nets. Now he's back with the Timberwolves, and the whole goal with that from their organizational point of view is they want to bring him in as a leader to show the new NBA players they have. You know, they have Karl Anthony Towns, they have Ricky Rubio, they have all these new players, like Andrew Wiggins, they have all these new guys who need to learn how to play in the NBA. And one of the things that Kevin Garnett has been famous for his entire career is just his pure, sheer intensity. He's the guy who's headbutting the stanchion for the basket and talking to it before the games. He's the guy who you can't take him out of practices because he feels that being taken out of practice is a sign of weakness. Like, they had to have serious discussions with him about, you need to sit this practice out so you can play the games. No. What? No. No, we need you later in the real games. He's like, I have to work on my teammates. So the thing with him is that this level of intensity is what he's trying to draw out of his teammates. And in order to do that, he challenges them over and over and over again, repeatedly and unapologetically. And that's kind of the heart of sports. But one of the quotes that he said recently about this was just...
This is my favorite.
It's fantastic. And I'm going to make sure I get it right.
Yeah,
here, so
yeah, I'm
going to
let you read it right off the paper.
And I can't do a Kevin Garnett voice, so you'll
We're
have to...
We're not expecting that, no.
So you have to stick with me on this. This is him referring to what it's like to help his teammates learn how to play in the NBA. You know, it's a lot like putting a bunch of puppies in a box and shaking it up. And you watch the puppies go at it a little bit. You know, it's fun. And this concept of... taking these young, impressionable puppies, players, whatever you want to do, and putting them in a situation where you sort of shake the box a little bit. You shake their understanding of what it is. It's a challenging way. So you're not necessarily teaching the puppy that can't fight back how to fight back. You're teaching the other puppies how to kill that one. You know?
Which, again, I want to be perfectly clear here.
And they're puppies.
Please, we don't condone right. puppy shaking.
And puppies, I mean, their whole thing is they're play fighting and, you know, they're not actually going to kill each other and all that. Right.
His metaphor makes some sense.
Let's walk it back a little.
Let's take it back a few steps. You know, Kevin Garnett is probably not shaking boxes of puppies on a regular basis. But he's applying it to this team. And I think what's interesting is, as you said, he was drafted by the Timberwolves. He went away for a while. And they're actually bringing him back specifically for this idea that, okay, he's late in his career. He's maybe not going to make as big an impact on the court as he used to, but you're bringing him back specifically for this part of his personality. Can he manage to pass this on to other players? But that's the big question, right? Because we look at somebody like Michael Jordan, huge competitor, obviously got... the one story about Michael Jordan I like is that they had a ping pong table in the locker room at one point, and he lost, and he got so angry that he went and hired a ping pong master to teach him ping pong so that he would never lose again.
Yeah.
Just competitive at every level against every player. But he didn't, to be perfectly frank, didn't do a great job of coming back and being an inspiration to younger players and being helpful.
And he continued to be sort of the same challenging player that he was early on. If you look back at sort of those Bulls teams, the players who stayed on that team were the players who could survive what Michael was putting through them through in practices. Like the number of fist fights that you hear about, the number of altercations, shoving, Bill Cartwright, like getting into it with him in the locker room. It's these stories where you're realizing that they're bringing out this core competitiveness. And are there multiple ways to do that? Do you always have to be going full on against somebody to bring out their competitiveness? So it becomes a question. Michael Jordan has ruined players' careers, ruined their confidence, because they weren't built up enough yet, and he was challenging them as players. So when we talk about this, the question for Kevin Garnett is he going to keep going at these players as a challenge, or is he going to try to step back and say, I can show you the way?
Mm.
And is it necessarily the right thing to even do that? Because you have to be who you are, not who everyone else thinks you should be. And you have to be kind of, sort of accurate and confident enough to do that.
I mean, it's a crazy challenge, right? And, we got talking about this, too, because we were looking at this, obviously, in terms of Ultimate, because this
is... We can't help ourselves.
This is what this show is about, but it's what this show is about, too.
Yeah.
So we're looking at this in terms of Ultimate, so we got talking a little bit about this, and, I started to think about, who are some people that we played with who maybe at the time were more Jordan-esque, more, what are some other good? Kobe Bryant, just about to retire, like more characters along those lines that maybe later picked up and developed into these teachers and stuff that you need, right? Because in Ultimate, we need to be able to perpetuate the game and the culture and all the things that are important to the next level and the next generation that's coming up. And it's way harder to do than it first might seem, particularly if you're playing at like this incredibly high level and this high competitive level, not just against other teams, but you're competitive with the people that you're playing with, because you have to make the squad, you have to make the starting seven, you have to do all that stuff. So there's this competitive level that you need to somehow transition into some ability to pass stuff on.
And this is one of the things that Doc Rivers, the coach of the Clippers at the time, was talking about what it was like to deal with Kevin Garnett. Or he was the coach of the Celtics at the time. He's the coach of the Clippers now.
Yeah, Celtics.
What it was like to deal with Kevin Garnett in those situations, and then comparing that to what he's trying to do now. And his quote along these lines was, you have to get the guys who are ready to who are ready to let go of who they were and be what you need them to be now. So it's this level of accepting that you were this thing before, and in order to help other people be their version of that, you have to accept that you are no longer that. So in practices sometimes, if you're the aging player, the younger guy is going to beat you, no matter how ready you think you are to deal with him tactically or physically or whatever. It's just a younger player. He has more energy, has this and that. But instead of just letting him beat you, how can you make him beat you in a way that will teach him how to be a better player? What can you show him in that process of victory and loss and all of that? Because it's challenging for an older player to accept loss, and it's challenging for a younger player to learn how to win.
I like that statement. That's pretty good. Remember
I'm
that.
Here to help.
Oh, I like that. Yeah, I'm going to write that one down. So the thing that I'm interested in, though, is, I'm with you, and I really like that quote from the coach there. Like, how do you take someone who played a certain type of role, was a certain thing, and now maybe you moved a bit out of that role, but how do you get them to apply it to coaching? You've actually been thinking about this too, because you right now are coaching.
Yeah.
Little shout out to the boys down in there in D.C.
Gotta love John Doe.
John Doe.
John Doe's a great team to coach.
A lot of good players on that team.
Yeah, and coaching, this is my first year coaching in about 10 years or so. This was my first year coaching. I'm looking forward to doing it in the future. And a perfect example of this was we were short players for one of our tournaments. We were down to about 13 or 12 guys. And I'm in reasonably okay shape. Am I in playing shape? No. And am I trying to go out there to be everything I can be? No, I'm just trying to go out and fill in some points here and there so that we don't get too tired over the course of a weekend. Turns out as soon as you step on that field, the thoughts going through your head revert to what you were as a player. So as a player, I don't really want to know the score. I just want to beat the guy in front of me. As a coach, I have to know the score. That's my job. That's why I'm there. As a player, I don't really want to think about my teammates. I just want to share with them. I want to play frisbee. I want to win.
Yeah.
As a coach, your whole job is to consider what your team as a whole is doing. So this being of two minds can be very difficult, not just for accomplished players, but for anybody at any level. And a lot of that has to do with insecurity as a player. So you, in order to accept that loss, one of the things that got you there in the first place was your insecurity as a player. The reason you work so hard is because you know you're not good enough yet and you can get there. So you're insecure about yourself and you put all this time and energy in and you fight against that very notion that you're not good enough. But at a certain point in your older career, you're not good enough. And you don't get to fight against it anymore.
You're probably not going to get a whole lot better at that point.
So what can you do at that point? What can you share? What can you bring across the team? And can you see the team as bigger than yourself? Because one of the ways to improve a team is to improve each one of the individual players as a player. Another way to improve the team is to work the team as a group to support those players who cover for their weaknesses and showcase their strengths. Mm. It's not necessarily the five best players that are the best team. It's the five players who put together the best, who come together and make a team the best.
Or seven, in the case.
In the case of Ultimate. Right. Contextually, basketball.
Basketball, Ultimate.
We go right back to Ultimate really quickly.
And I think about that, too. You mentioned that thing about making individual players better. I think that there is a thing in, like, Michael Jordan's case, or players who are of that mind, that the way to make an individual player better is to put them on the same level as yourself and expect them to beat you or to compete against you. And they do feel like, I guarantee you, they feel like they're making people better that way. Whereas really a lot of the time they're just humiliating.
Well, yes, but that's the difficult thing in sports is that sometimes that moment of humiliation is the thing that spurs you to work harder.
It could be, yeah.
I mean, personally, the thing that made me work harder as a player is Dave Hollander.
Oh, yeah.
So after we played in 2004, at Nationals, we had that great run into semis. It was a wonderful thing, just wonderful.
Good time.
And we're sitting there at the end of this game. We lost it 15-13 to Sockeye. And I'm asking Dave, who was 39 or 40. He was one of the elder statesmen on our team at that point.
Was he like, that old then?
Yeah. But he didn't play
Dave.
Like it.
Dave.
and he looked at me first. I was like, what can I do better for next year? How can I play more in this game? How can I make my team better? And he just looked at me kind of blankly and coldly and like, I could see he was thinking it over to choose his words, and he's like, "You're 20 pounds too heavy." And to have the confidence to say that to someone,
Dave, are you calling me fat?
Like, but and he was.
Yeah,
but
he was.
That made me look at myself and say, "Hey, without this extra 20 pounds of extra weight, I could be a lot faster. It's faster to move 160 pounds than it is 180 pounds.
Yeah.
It takes less force." So then you look at it, and the things that I got from that, I wasn't trying to lose 20 pounds. I was trying to make myself faster because I knew what he was getting at. It needed to be easier for me to move. But in that moment, I kind of wanted to reach over and slap him. You know, but he was one of those players that could, he was like an elder statesman on the team. He understood, like, in practice, he was going to kick your behind.
Yeah.
He's going to work you over as best he can. But he's also there realizing that it's later on for him. And he's trying to bring things to the rest of us. And that moment made all the difference for me.
Yeah, I think that that's important. It's that he, I think what he understood is that was the specific thing for you.
Right.
And I think someone who's grown up in the game and someone who's reached that point where they can think less about who they are and more about who the other people are, that's a good example of it, yeah. Right? And finding the ability to look at someone's game outside the context of your own is challenging. We were talking earlier about Jay Dono, who we both played with. So, hey, Jay.
Shout out to Jay.
Little shout out to Jay.
One of my favorite teammates of all time.
Yeah, oh, absolutely. And I played with Jay in college. And at that point, you know, he was relatively new to the game himself, as far as I know, and was a phenomenal defender. You know, just from natural innate ability.
I'm thinking of him right now today, and he's probably still a phenomenal defender, defending his kids from something.
Oh, yeah.
You know?
He's intercepting children from hot stoves with full extension layouts. There's no question about it. And he'll point to Jim Mento, who is a guy who played in the Rochester area, who is a great defender, right? So there's this kind of thing about that. So when I came in, I happen to have a lot of similar sort of attributes to Jay, similar type of player in some ways. He's a little springier. I don't know where he gets that, but
you're a little taller.
Then I'm a little taller, so I make up for the springiness. But so when he taught me how to play defense, he got to use his very basic teaching skills, which totally only came from what he did, and were not applicable to 90% of the people that.
Yes, for example, when he tried to teach me how to play defense, I had to tell him that I can't do the things that he can do. It was a very different experience.
Yeah, so his basic defensive approach was the throw it, throw it, throw it, fool approach, meaning that you were supposed to just put yourself in a position where it looked like your guy was open, which in layman's terms means a position where your guy is open. And then when the throw goes up, you make him not open.
And that was the part that I was never able to solve.
How
do I do that?
Yeah. And he never explained how.
Yeah.
It's just how you did it. But later on, and you have more experiences in this than I do, because I only played a couple of years of this
club.
Some
of us retire early intelligently. Some of us retire at the end at someone else's behest.
We'd rather
either Father Time or your teammates look at you and say, you know what?
How do you feel about coaching?
I took it the other way. How do I feel about coaching?
I like that. Yeah,
that sounds good. Coach Rhodes.
So you worked with Jay later, and Jay, I think, had grown to a point where he had started to understand other people's abilities and other people's place in the game and how to translate that. And that is the big maturing of a player, I would say, right?
It's the same as a person. You know, it's seeing the world through your perspective as well as trying to see the world through the perspectives of others. The same things that help you in sports tend to help you in real life. It's not accident, because sports are just real life with random rules. Arbitrary rules is a better way. Random is too overused.
Yeah, real life with arbitrary rules. I like that. Sports. That comes from, there you go. That's your quote of the, that's your quote of the thing. That'll be, Tom will put that in the social media post for this. So the end game is that what we ended up talking about, and we ramble, this is what we do, but what we ended up talking about was, who are the people coming up now that are going to move this sport forward? Who are going to become those next leaders, and how are they going to get there? There are all these great players, and, you know, Ultimate's interesting right now because in a lot of ways the participation in the sport is still governed by the time you have to spend on it, the kind of money you have to spend on it, how much you can commit to it, because it's nobody's sort of full-time gig. You know, there's you don't have the lifestyle choice of Kevin Garnett to be able to pour all of your being into this and spend, you know, 30 minutes talking to a
just before the game.
Yeah, talking to a basketball.
Just so we're all right.
Yeah. So, you know, this is, it's governed by that to some extent. So the people that are going to stay here and that are going to be those leaders are people who are able to balance the life that they've chosen and the sport and fit all those pieces together while at the same time making this transition from top level, hyper competitive to the ability to not necessarily even tone down the competitiveness, but redirect it into supporting and inspiring other people.
I think it's key to almost harp on the idea of not toning down the competitiveness.
Yeah.
Because it's that sort of thing that you can be competitive in multiple different ways. You can be competitive about individual things, team level. You can be cutthroat about it. You can accept your losses. You can be a bad loser, a good loser, a bad winner, a good winner. But all of those things, attachment to the result on some level is what makes it possible to have a competition.
Yeah.
Like if we didn't care about the results, we wouldn't have a score. If we didn't have a score, we wouldn't be... Like it's this whole stream of things where we have to agree that something matters to us and we're going to have a competition to see who wins.
Absolutely. And so we're not going to answer this question now. And obviously we have taken a really roundabout route to get where we're going, as we always do. Whenever
we're going somewhere.
Nah, I'm not sure. But what we will say is if you're out there and you want to let us know your thoughts on this, who are the players out there in Ultimate right now who have kind of made this transition from the young players to the elder statesmen, as Dusty put it. You know, who are the people who are in the position that Kevin Garnett's in when they're trying to figure out which way they're going to go? You can obviously send us a tweet at Cleats Cufflinks on Twitter. You can get me at Nick Darling.
Dust Wheat Roads.
Dust Wheat Roads.
D-U-S-T-W-E-E-T Roads.
Roads.
R-H-O-D-E-S.
Yeah, all right. Now,
just do better searching for Dusty Rhodes and figuring it out for there. It's kind of tough.
You'll find him. But send us what your thoughts are. We'd love to hear about it. Who are the people we should be keeping an eye on? Who should we recognize? Who should we know? And we'll bring it up on the next show with whoever is sitting over here next time. See what they think. We'll transition a little bit, though, right now. So the other thing that we were talking about this morning over our delicious Honey's breakfast, which, by the way, we've mentioned that twice in the show now, so free breakfast should be forthcoming, I would imagine.
That's the best part of every radio show. Free stuff.
Free stuff. That's the only reason we're here.
Just ask Tony Kornheiser. He's all about the free stuff.
Is that true?
Oh, yeah.
That's his thing?
Oh, yeah.
Sports radio.
Wouldn't you be if you had the opportunity?
Absolutely. I've been doing it. This is episode 28, and free stuff has not shown up yet. But I'm assuming, I don't know what number you have to hit.
This is the first time I've been in the place, so I'm not sure if the free stuff only shows up when I'm not here.
I wouldn't tell you otherwise. But the other thing we were talking about was we were looking at our box score. So we're looking at the way that people see a snapshot of how a game happens. And, you know, generally it's just the basic box score up at the very top of the page, not all the in-depth stats, was just points, so total scores, and then points broken down by quarter. But we talked about the fact that there is a significant part of this game that's a little bit different from other games, particularly other team sports.
Mm-hmm.
And that is that during a given point, there are or can be both offensive and defensive possessions, as we would call them. So the team that started on offense can have the disc, and then on a turnover, the team that started on defense will then be on offense. So in that way, we look at a point as having two eventual outcomes for the offensive or defensive team. That is that if you start on offense and you score, that's called what we call a hold, or mm-hmm. holding serve is where that comes from, correct?
Yeah.
Though there is a term that other people use that you really hate, if I recall.
The idea of being on serve extends the tennis analogy one step further than I'm comfortable with.
Right.
Because holding and breaking, you hold and break serve in tennis, you hold and break serve in volleyball. But in Ultimate, there isn't really a serve, and you don't hold or break the pull. So the idea of the word serve, so do we really need the word serve in our vocabulary?
Right, because if you technically thought of the pull as the serve, then the effect would be opposite.
Exactly, the defensive team would be the one being on serve.
Right.
This is my whole problem. I have a very difficult time following it, and I can't imagine that I'm the only one.
No, I don't think that's the same. But so the terminology we've come up with that we like and that other people have used, but that we are using very explicitly, is that you can either hold on a point or you can break on a point. So a hold is when the team that starts on offense scores, and that's because it is statistically much easier to score when you start on offense.
Yes.
So on a given point, looking over the last 3 years of the MLU, on a given point, what is the percentage of time that the team that starts on offense scores?
The answer is 62%.
62%.
62.
That's significant.
That is brought to us by Luke, our statistician.
Luke Ryan, yep.
And he's also the first person I heard use hold and break consistently in this terminology, although I've heard other people do it. But the idea that when you start with this first, you score 62% of the time. So you have a significant advantage when you start with the Frisbee, start receiving the Frisbee.
Receiving the Frisbee. And then what chance does the defensive team have to break over the last 3 years? What is the percentage chance the defense has to break?
28.99%.
28.99%. Significantly less. Now,
yes, significantly.
Yeah, stating the obvious. Now, those don't add up to 100%. So yeah. What's happening? Are we losing points?
Yes, in a sense.
In a sense.
But we're losing points because the clock runs out at the end of the quarter.
Right.
So unlike in an untimed game of Ultimate, in which every individual point must end in either a goal for one team or the other, when the clock runs out, we stop. So that means at the end of as many as four periods over the course of a game, you can have a possession that ends in neither a goal for neither team, which skews the data a little bit compared to untimed ultimate. So that leaves you about 10% where there is no score whatsoever. That doesn't happen four times per game. Usually it happens about three times per game. Usually at least one team manages to score on the final possession. But the way that plays out is interesting. Because in a situation where you think it's the last, so you're trying to time it to get the last goal, and then you put up that pass and it's caught with 1 second left, well, now the other team has a possession on offense where they have a second, so they get tagged with that.
They're
extra,
getting tagged with that missing.
Yeah, and that's percentage. Sort of where a lot of teams found a way to make up ground on other teams to get their way back into the game. Boston was particularly successful at this over a number of years, and DC has sort of ramped that up a bit. The Rainmakers last year were also doing a consistently better job at that.
So what's interesting about this is that within that point, if we look at possessions, that number is actually significantly closer together. So on a point where you start on offense in a given possession, which means that during the time before you turn the disc over, which teams do with some regularity, what is your percentage chance of scoring?
So the O-line's percentage of chance of scoring on possessions is 44.66%. So that's, to most people who think of Ultimate without looking at the numbers, that's a really low number. That means you are actually more likely to turn it over on a given offensive possession than you are to score.
So, and then when you turn it over, obviously the D-line is now on offense.
Yep.
And their percentage chance of scoring is not that much lower.
It's only a little bit lower. It's still significant, but it's 38.69%. So whether it's the exhaustion or the players have less offensive skill or it's just a combination of things working together, it's slightly less likely for any given D-point possession for that team to score than it is for an O-point possession, for an offensive possession.
Gotcha. So the thing that the one stat I wish we had now that I just started to think about is, what is the average number of possessions it takes for an offense to score that 60-some percent of the time that they do?
I can tell you that it's more likely that they will score on the first two than even get to the third.
There's like a diminishing returns.
Yeah, because once you get to the third offensive possession, that also means that the defense has had two chances to score.
Right.
And,
and they're doing that at 38.6% of the time.
Which
is... That the statistics are starting to go out of your favor by the time you get a couple.
But that key advantage of just having the opportunity to score first affects the balance of the point more than it affects the balance of the individual possession.
Gotcha. So with all that said, one of the big things that we wanted to do with the box score was to be able to show this.
Yeah, to reflect that a little bit more.
So now what we're looking at doing is, instead of just having score versus score, it's score versus score broken down also by breaks and holds.
Yeah.
So each quarter breaks and holds, full game breaks and holds. And from our perspective, that's going to give us a better picture of the overall work that the two teams did during the game.
Yeah. I mean, you keeping track of, if you are only going to keep track of one thing in an ultimate game, the thing that you want to keep track of is break goals. If you lose track of all of the holds for every team, you'll still have a very good sense of who is going to win this game based on break goals. And the fact that a standard ultimate box score that not only we've used, but that everybody who has tried to do ultimate box scores has used, is it lacks break goals. And that's the most important thing in your game, is breaking the other team's offense more than they break your team's offense.
Right on. All right, well, we've rambled our way through a full 29 minutes and 45 seconds now, so we're going to get to wrap up now. Dust Tweet Roads, if it's in there, at Nick Darling, at Cleet Scufflings, or you can email us if you're not into that whole Twitter thing and you lack that kind of brevity. Send us an email at cleetsandcufflings@mlultimate.com. Dusty, thank you so much for coming on.
It's my pleasure.
We'll do this again sometime, and we'll be looking forward to hearing you calling games next year. All right, and that's all we have for today.